Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking to Lila Levinson about her book, Gated Grief, The Daughter of a GI Concentration Camp Liberator Discovers a Legacy of Trauma. I'd like now to introduce City Councilor and Mayor Pro Tem Rebecca Wurzberger. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning. Thank you.
So we are here to talk about all sorts of things that have to do with creative cities, creative tourism. You've been traveling the world. You were in December at a UNESCO meeting of the Creative Cities Network. Santa Fe is a so-called creative city. This was in China. What was it all about?
Okay, let me first just give a little bit of background on creative cities, if I may. I want to remind our listeners that Santa Fe was selected as the second city in the world to be part of this network in the year 2006, and we were selected because of our excellence in folk art and design, particularly the folk art market and the museum. And since that time, we in 2008 sponsored the first international conference on creative tourism, which was designed to showcase the unique cultural assets of Santa Fe. And that has been the intention and purpose of our participation in the UNESCO network, is to create a global platform so that we can bring more people to Santa Fe as tourists to spend their money and to learn about our culture and participate in all the magic that we have here.
Now, speaking of money, you were in China, and tourism is, when you talk about China, you talk about rising middle class and people really traveling.
People are really traveling. They have a burgeoning growth rate. I met with the director of tourism in Shanghai, and he pointed out that their growth rate is something like 10% a year. And they travel primarily to first Asia, secondly, Europe, and thirdly, the United States.
Ah.
And as part of my meeting, it became very clear that they never heard of New Mexico, much less Santa Fe. And I think that's why it's very important for us as a city to reach out and have the personal opportunities to start the dialogue on how we can bring people here.
So when you're talking about a country with a billion people in it, how do you start reaching out?
Well, you reach out just like what I did when I was in China. You sit down with the head of tourism. I also was sitting with his
head. Of a particular city.
Of a particular city. I'm sorry, I think you go local. Like, that's it. You go one-to-one, and you say, this is what our city's about. I took a package from the Commission and Business Bureau. I learned very quickly, I had a PowerPoint, that that's not what we were going to do. We were going to sit there and talk. And you open a door on a very formal basis, and he spent about 20 minutes explaining to me what the priorities were for Shanghai travelers, and that underscored the fact that they are traveling, demystifying that myth that Chinese can't leave. They
right.
can leave.
Is that a myth that this is a it is,
it
communist
is increasing
country that's a prison or
that's
something?
That's a prison. He pointed out that one of the opportunities he presented for us was to have our CBB director come over to their Shanghai Travel Expo. CBB is the Convention and Business Bureau.
Right.
Sorry, Keith Toller's our director.
Right.
And he pointed out that unlike many of the travel shows that happen worldwide, this one is not just booths for people who show their cities, that the people who come are actually individuals who want to do the travel. Now, they do have to travel through a named travel agent in China, so it's absolutely necessary that we make those connections with the people who are responsible in China for putting these trips together.
Now, have you thought about putting trips together for these tourism people themselves to
yes.
come to Santa Fe?
We at this meeting, I made the offer and the invitation for the director of their international travel to come to Santa Fe and to bring at least two or three of the agents who are working under the government to see that people travel. He said that they come a couple of times a year to the United States. And we're hopeful we'll be following up on this invitation that they'll come sometime in 2011.
So let's go back to this UNESCO meeting that you were part of, the Creative Cities Network. There's, what, a few dozen cities?
There are 27 cities now. We were number two. And when we did our conference, unfortunately, there were only eight cities, you know, to have as a base for the conference. Nevertheless, we had 16 countries come to that conference. But now we have 27 cities and 23 we're actually at the meeting. I want to share some of the names of the cities to give you an idea of the diversity. We have Melbourne, Dublin, Iowa City, United States, Bradford, Glasgow, Ghent, Kanazawa, Incheon, Nagoya, Kobe, Shenzhen, Shanghai, and Seoul.
Very interesting.
Also Sydney. They were just added last week.
Okay.
Sydney and Saint-Étienne.
Now, some of these cities, I and probably our listeners know where they are. Some of them we have not the slightest clue.
Oh, we're doing it again to the country?
Well,
I could try.
And even if you know where they are, you don't have a sense of what this city is and why it's creative. We have this sense of sort of the ethos of Santa Fe
right.
as a place with history and multiple cultures and unusual architecture and folk art tradition and so on. But
well, see, this is what's wonderful, I think, about the concept of the Creative Cities Network, because it's designed as a platform of exchange and educates people around the world about what's happening in other cities with respect to creativity. For example, Edinburgh is a city of literature. I never knew. I'm a big reader. I never knew that.
Right.
And I've never been for their famous literature festival.
Right.
A city that's being considered right now is Hangzhou, China. They're the silk capital of the world. The most beautiful silk patterns you have ever seen. Incheon, Korea, which we've actually had one exchange with them already, and we'll probably have more even this year. They are a city of ceramics, and the ceramics look like something, you know, the ceramic is inside of a ceramic, with the woven, the outside is all woven, and you can see through to the inner bowl, and there are these wonderful celadon greens.
So it makes you want to go to all of these cities.
I've done some of that, but it once you have that opportunity, and I think exchanging ideas across the city is just a powerful tool for enriching our own culture.
So were you there exchanging ideas with people from Melbourne and Kobe and so on?
We did that on the first day, and you do it at the after hours. Unfortunately, I was elected vice chair, or given the honor of being vice chair of the conference, so I ended up working about 14 hours a day and not having a lot of that
right.
time that's at the end of the day to work. We did a paper on the agreements that came out of the conference, and I helped chair that.
And so what did come out of the conference?
Well, what came out of the conference was a commitment to work on new media. I have a copy of the communique somewhere in this package, but it's basically the idea that we would, first of all, among the creative cities, create a digital platform so that we could quickly be connected. And one of the keynote speakers at the conference was the man who owns the largest internet company in China. Now, this is big because you're talking billions rather than
yes.
thousands. And he gave a commitment to helping the network gratis do this. So that's one thing that happened. I think on Wednesday at City Council, I'm having Frank Regano, who traveled with me as our expert in new media. He's going to be talking about what some of the innovative ideas were.
Who did that wonderful, who was part of that wonderful Currents video exhibition
right.
that happened last year.
Well, one of the other things that came out of the conference was we had, as I said, three keynotes, one of whom was Renee Barcelot, who is from Montreal. And Renee heads up a group that is concerned with cross-disciplinary center dedicated to research, creation, production, presentation, and education in the field of digital culture. And he would describe such things as having a multi-story building, and how even now in Montreal you can go up to the building and there'll be a light pattern, and you with your cell phone can go up and change the light pattern according to the music that you want.
Right.
So it's a very, and this relates to creative tourism, by the way, the notion of engaging people hands-on in creating the art on the spot. That's one of the things that's being pursued as a technology. And he has indicated that he would like to come to Santa Fe in March. And so we'll be convening a meeting of interested people from the community to talk to them about specifically what they've done in Montreal.
So there's two really important things that are coming out of this. One is the exchange of ideas among all of these people from creative cities and getting ideas of things that we can do in our own city and that we can give to others and so on. And the other is getting warm bodies from other countries
right.
into Santa Fe to spend money at hotels, restaurants.
Well, that has been my number one goal. We are the only city in the network that has made creative tourism as one of our primary objectives. I mean, it's secondary for others. Other cities are really using it as a branding opportunity that does get people to come to their city. So I guess I shouldn't make that distinction, because a conference is being proposed for mayors by Seoul, Korea, where they'll talk about how do you take the branding as a UNESCO creative city and use that to your advantage in a variety of ways. I was in China 10 days. The conference only lasted 5. I had 4 days of travel on each end. I mean, 2 days on each end. But I stayed the extra days so that I could make those direct contacts on the tourism issue. And I had two opportunities for that. One, as I said, was with the director of tourism of Shanghai. And the other is that I met with the director of the Hong Kong Trade Development Center. And that's the one that I mentioned to you earlier. They had a trade expo which had creative ideas from around the world. So creative, I thought I would be there an hour, and I was there 7 hours. And as I shared earlier, listeners might think this is funny, that I thought, well, I should cut off my arm and put on a Japanese prosthetic because it was so beautiful. I mean, the design level was unbelievable.
Rebecca, that's
messed up. I know, that's
up.
Sick. I know it's messed up. But I'm saying, that's what I thought. Wow, that's really beautiful. Imagine on a more positive note, they had a baby grand piano that was totally fluid. It had been, take the concept of baby grand piano and totally redesign it. Now, that was the expo, which doesn't relate to tourism, but then I met with the director when I returned to Hong Kong on the way back to the States, and she supervises 1,000 people whose job is to make connections with other countries and collaborations with Hong Kong and China. And she's committed already to she's already sent a letter to two people that will affect our mission of getting more people here. One is her director in San Francisco that runs a similar agency, that she will come here to talk to business leaders about how they can collaborate. And then equally importantly, she's written a personal letter to the director of tourism in Hong Kong to introduce us. So we'll be following on that.
Now, we're talking to Rebecca Wurzberger, City Councilor of Santa Fe and Mayor Pro Tem. One of the myths that we have to get over is that the Chinese can't leave China.
Oh, true. They can. They not only can, they are. They are the number one growing travel market or travelers in the world. Their growth rate in comparison to ours, which is flat, is 10% a year. And when you're looking at millions of people, that makes a major difference.
Which has environmental implications that are
That's true. Terrifying,
but nevertheless, for tourism.
For tourism, it would be good.
Yeah.
I've said for several years now that if we could get 0.0001% of the Chinese market, we wouldn't have to be putting people on furlough right now.
Right.
And I feel very passionate about that, because creating industries, I'm all for creating new industries, new businesses, green industry, that takes time. We're at a crisis situation now with respect to our budgets. Tourism and what we have to offer in Santa Fe is real, it's ready. We just need to spend more time getting people here to take advantage of it and spend their money, as you say.
I think we are in danger of laboring under the illusion that everybody knows about Santa Fe. That's
Thank
not
you.
Necessarily true.
This is why I have worked on this issue for over 4 years now. And I shared with you the story earlier that when UNESCO came here and announced the Creative Cities program, the woman who introduced it, Milagros de Corral from Spain, stood up and described Santa Fe and all of its cultural assets and beauty and magic in a way I had never heard, as though she had lived here forever. And then she ended that statement with, "I never knew Santa Fe existed." And that was my call. Once I heard that, I felt...
Well, if they don't know about us in Spain, they certainly aren't going to know about us in Shanghai.
Well, and that was true. When I sat down with the director of tourism, he was very polite, But he made it clear that he didn't know where New Mexico was, and I explained where New Mexico was, and then he had never heard of Santa Fe. And we do have that illusion, and I think that it has stood in our way of making progress, because if they don't know we're here, they're not going to come. So let's start with that. Could I just say one other thing, and it's a bias that I have, Mary Charlotte. I don't think having an internet ad is going to get them here.
Well, that's what you I was know. Just going to say, oh, okay. is that what you're talking about really points to the reality that all business, all politics, and everything that actually ends up happening is about personal relationships.
I believe that, and China showed that. I feel so comfortable now that we can really develop work with Shenzhen, both in terms of business and in terms of tourism. And the door is opening to Shanghai, and it's yet to be tapped on in Hong Kong. Okay.
Are there any services or special things that we would have to do to make Santa Fe more welcoming to Asian tourists? I don't know, linguistic things or...
Well, generally, my experience has been... And we had 11 people, for example, come from Shenzhen to our conference. They brought their translator with them.
So having a translator isn't an issue because they're bringing translators from
abroad.
They
are generally. Now, as we get, and I think that may be true with tours, but we would have to, you know, we have to learn that.
Right.
We do have several people who've indicated interest in the community now that they've heard about this trip. They're from China, or they lived in China, or they're partly living in China right now, and they're interested in helping work on this issue of bringing more tourists here. So I think some of the resources are here that we could find a Chinese translator if we had to.
Right.
That would not be a problem.
There are also some impediments that make people not want to travel to the United States
this
from
is
abroad.
True. When I was in Shanghai talking, no, pardon me, in Hong Kong, the director there, Margaret Fong, talked to me. She's been to Santa Fe. She loves Santa Fe. That's how I met her, and that's how I got the invitation to talk with her there. She said that many of her friends simply don't want to come through U.S. Customs and be fingerprinted. They have a problem with that. And now that we've gone to body searches, they have even a bigger problem with that. So we do have...
I've got a problem with
that. I have a problem with that as well. So we do have... if we really want to move forward as a country, we have to work with our federal delegation to deal with this issue.
Yeah, that's a very... I mean, we have such a... In the national media and in the national mind right now, we have such an idea that it's all about terrorism and we've forgotten tourism.
That's correct. I guess I can share this story. I'm a little hesitant, but when we were doing the planning meeting for our Creative City International Conference on Creative Tourism, we had 7 of the 8 cities come together to help us plan that meeting. We had 3 delegates from Egypt, very tall, very elegant, very educated men. The last day of the meeting, they disappeared. And I thought, that is very strange. I can't believe they would just leave. Well, they had been taken to be interrogated while they were here in Santa Fe, not by locals, by federals, because they just wanted to check their passports. This is something that can't happen. When we had our next conference...
Yeah, nobody will ever come back if they go home and tell their friends.
So the next time we had a conference, I can't remember which one we were doing that was international, we made a special effort to meet with the federal agencies and gave them the names of people who were coming to the conference. So I'm just...
And it didn't happen.
And it did not happen.
Right.
So this is, that's just a story. As a true happening here, I would never have imagined that happening in Santa Fe in a million years. So you're absolutely correct. And as I've expressed the opinion of the lady with whom I was speaking in Hong Kong, they have the perceptions. And the perceptions are based on reality.
Anything else you want to add before we go?
Well, I guess one of the things, you know, I guess a major high for me is, in terms of media, is that, first of all, it was paparazzi everywhere. There were times, especially on the day that I was leading the meeting, I told people, sit down. We're talking droves of photographers, and especially when the Chinese, the director of the internet service stood up, you couldn't see what was on the stage. But, one of the highlights in terms of promoting our city is that there is an English-speaking Chinese newspaper called the Shenzhen Daily. We had a major headline article. I'm sorry, it serves 1 million Chinese daily. Major article, headline, famous art city to collaborate with Shenzhen. And it was 6 columns on Santa Fe.
Very interesting.
And well, I have a copy of that for you if you want.
I assume you're following up and that we will hear more about this.
I've written 20 letters already, and we've already delegated. I'll be reporting to council on Wednesday which staff and which community members and which committees can follow up on the ideas that have been generated.
Rebecca Wurzburger is city councilor and mayor pro tem, talking about creative tourism. Are there any resources that people can find on the net or whatever if they want more information?
Oh, thank you. Yes. First of all, you should go to santafecreativetourism.org. And that's the list of our 120, 130 artists now in Santa Fe who are online. It's a city website and available for doing creative hands-on experiences with tourists. So that's one thing. I'd like to end with a quote, if I may, because I forgot that. As I've reflected on my trip, and you may be too young, but The Graduate was a film in the 60s.
Yes, I remember.
And the most famous sentence was when the man tapped him on the shoulder and said, "The future is plastics." I say, for the future of tourism, the future is China. And we need to work on this. Thank you.
Rebecca Wurzburger, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's great.
I'd like to introduce Lila Levinson. She is the author of the book Gated Grief, the daughter of a GI concentration camp liberator discovers a legacy of trauma. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much, Mary Charlotte. Great to be here.
You are the daughter of a World War II veteran. He was an Army doctor. You knew him as your dad, the doctor. He was one of hundreds of thousands of GIs who liberated the concentration camps, but you did not know his story until after his death when you found a trunk of his war belongings. What did you find?
Well, soon, just a few days after he died very suddenly of a heart attack, my brother and I went to his medical office. And down in the basement was the trunk, which had always fascinated me as a child because a Nazi helmet sat on top of it, which always did a really good job of keeping me at arm's length. It was pretty scary to me. And but now I was curious as to what my father had been keeping in there, and opened it up, and there was a shoebox full of photographs, hundreds of photographs, that he obviously had started taking from the moment he got on the ship to cross the English Channel, the eve of D-Day, all the way through landing in Utah Beach, the clearing station, his medical battalion set up on the cliffs there after they were able to scale them, all the way across France and Belgium. And he had spoken very, very little. I did have some idea he had been involved in D-Day and even maybe the Battle of the Bulge. But at the bottom of the box were these images that totally, totally astounded me. They showed countless skeletal bodies. And the box, the backs of the photographs said Nordhausen Concentration Camp, April 1945. And I just didn't have any idea what these were doing in the box. I just told myself there was no way he had seen a concentration camp. But then a few weeks later, I brought it up with an aunt, and she said, "Yes, your father's division liberated a camp, and because he was a doctor, he had to stay to treat the survivors. And after a few weeks of that, he had a mental breakdown and was sent to the French Riviera for R&R and didn't come home for many, many months after everyone else came back from the war."
And so you pieced this together partly through conversations with relatives. He'd never told you any of this himself, nor really left written records.
No, he didn't even hint at it. I mean, my family's Jewish, and we even had a cantor at our synagogue who was missing most of his right hand, and I asked about that, and my stepmother would say, well, he was in a place during the war called Auschwitz, and that's what the Nazis did to him. But the Holocaust was really never talked about in my household. And one time I went to see a movie called Night and Fog by Alain René. That was the first movie ever made about the genocide of the Jews. And I came home hysterical when I realized how millions of Jews had been gassed and burned. And I'll never forget, my father stood there in the living room, wagging his finger at me, saying, "Don't think this can't happen here." and then turned around and went upstairs into his bedroom and closed the door. So there was just no conversation about it at all, which made the realization that he had witnessed a camp all the more shocking to me.
That statement, "don't think this can't happen here," is so resonant and scary that I wondered what you've thought about that over the years.
Well, it certainly didn't help me feel very safe and secure. You know, and we in America up until 9/11 always felt very safe and secure. I mean, you know, other than the Revolution and the Civil War, all the huge wars after that have occurred far away from us, right? You know, World War II was Europe's war, and we just helped out. That's the scenario we like to believe. But those words of my father's have always haunted me, and I set out to, I wanted to make sense of what did this mean that my father had witnessed a camp? How might that explain the enigma of the very silent, melancholy, detached man I grew up with? And so I got a grant, and I traveled all around the country to meet other World War II veterans who had helped to liberate the camps. And I talked to over 70 of them. And for many of them, I also talked to their children. And it was amazing how many children heard those sorts of things from their fathers also. Even like, always keep your passport current. Always have a suitcase packed. And that's just kind of amazing, you know, that we can't trust that we're safe in America. So where would we be safe, right?
Right. It's funny, because when I read those words, I thought, this is not just about Jews. This is about any group that is in disfavor at the moment, here and anywhere else.
Right. Any minority anywhere. Yeah. And, you know, the interesting thing is when I talk to the veterans themselves, and I saw this really true with my father, too, their one overriding goal when they came home from the war was to move on with their lives, focus on their families, and raise children that they could protect, to create a sense of security for the children. I mean, that was such a common word, security. I can't tell you how much I heard that in my home. And yet the irony is that I don't think they were even conscious that when they would say things to us like, keep your bags packed, or, you know, don't think it can't happen here, how that was creating a complete feeling of vulnerability. And the other thing that I realized in my research is that trauma, that the physiological and spiritual reaction to a moment of terror, prevent what it does to a person is shut down their ability to take in a lot of information. Because really, when you're in a moment of being terrified, if you take in all the information out there, it would overwhelm you, and you probably would have a complete breakdown you could not recover from. But the unfortunate thing is that after the moment of trauma is over, the person doesn't really develop that sensory receptivity again unless they've gone through healing. So my father, for all of his best intentions to raise my brothers and me in a safe, secure environment, wasn't able to do that at all. He wasn't able to understand and recognize how my mother was falling very ill with alcoholism and intervene to protect my brothers and me from the worst fallout from that. He wasn't able to recognize how depressed I was as a teenager and young adult. In fact, an aunt suggested to him that I should be in therapy, and he said, oh, Lila's fine. She's got no problems. You know, so the I think that's the ultimate tragic irony of trauma, is that it prevents the person who most cares about their family members from being able to recognize and respond to the fallout of their trauma for those family members.
We're talking to Lila Levinson, author of the book Gated Grief. Now, you talked to dozens of these veterans who were World War II concentration camp liberators, and what you found, I mean, this was decades later, and some of them had, after many, many years of silence, begun to open up. Some of them didn't want to talk to you at all. Some of them did, but only up to a point. Some of them wanted to focus on different things. That locking away of painful, I mean, beyond painful, just unspeakable memories, memories that are so horrible that even when you put words to them, you can't really describe them. Mm-hmm. That's a survival strategy. It might be maybe a good one, considering what the alternative was. I mean, in your father's case, he had a mental breakdown. What, I mean, is that kind of trauma healable?
Well, you know, it was very difficult for the GI liberators when they came back to know how to respond to this unbelievable experience they had had. You know, you and I have grown up since World War II, and so we've always known about the Holocaust. It's been part of our historic landscape. But the GIs, I mean, until they entered the gates, nobody outside of the Nazis and the victims had any idea that mankind was capable of such evil. And so they came back to the States, and many of their family members didn't want to hear about it, even if the GIs tried to talk about it. And they also, the GIs felt like, who were they to talk about their pain? They only were in the camp a few hours or a few weeks. What about the survivors? So that also was censoring them. And so we also need to remember that during World War II, PTSD wasn't even a term. They had the term battle fatigue in World War II. They had the term soldier's heart for the Civil War. So people have always been aware that war can take a terrible toll on the person. But the government certainly wasn't able or even willing to deal with the emotional, psychological fallout for the soldiers. So even if these men had wanted to go get help, there really wasn't any available. I mean, it was horrifying to me. There's a book called Flashback by Penny Coleman where she details what sorts of help was available for the World War II GIs, and it's scary. I mean, there were a lot of lobotomies done, and then they found the drug Thorazine and put all the guys on that, and the wards were overflowing with psychological casualties, so nobody wanted to go anywhere near that. So I really think they didn't have much of an option besides locking it up, you know? But I think the main point of my book is that we must, as a society, given how many veterans we have returning right now from Iraq and Afghanistan, we must recognize that when a veteran locks up his terrible, terrible memories, there is huge, huge fallout for the family. Because you don't just lock away the grief and the pain. It seeps out through the silence, and children are like sponges, and they absorb that, and they don't have any modeling of emotional resiliency. They don't have any modeling of how to talk through emotions, how to respond to emotions. They're learning that emotions are scary and to shut them out. And then you have a whole generation of very depressed people turning to Prozac, you know? We need to start connecting the dots in our country.
Well, and the thing about people who are in your position, children of these camp liberators, children of veterans with horrifying trauma, it's not even, you're depressed, but it's not even your trauma. So if you try to pinpoint it, you can't even figure out what it is. At least they know what it was.
Right. I grew up feeling like I was living in a fog, in some sort of a bewildering. I just had no idea why things were the way they were. Even as a very young child, I knew this is sort of crazy. What's going on here? I couldn't figure out. Like, we would sit at the dinner table, and my father would put on albums of Barbra Streisand and the Yale Whiffen Poofs, you know, to kind of fill the silence. And I kept thinking, we're sitting here almost like playing charades. There's something else going on here, but I don't know what it is. And a child fills in the blanks with their imagination. And I think almost the cruelest thing about the way the human brain is configured is that children, if something's going wrong in their family, in their household, they blame themselves.
Right.
And that's just so cruel, I think. You know, it's just heartbreaking how children do that. And so if they'll know if something's being hidden from them. And so they'll come up with the probably worst-case scenario in their minds of what it is that's being hidden.
Now, let's talk more about what you found during these interviews of veterans that you conducted. Were there common characteristics, common experiences that these many different people showed you during the conversations that you had?
Yeah, you know, one reason that I ended up doing this research is I taught a literature of the Holocaust course at a university here in Austin called St. Edward's. And I wanted to bring in some literature by the liberators because most of my students, it was very difficult for them to imagine a Jew in Europe in 1939. I actually was often the first Jew these students met, which sort of amazes me. But they all had grandfathers in World War II. And so I only could find two books about the liberators, and none of them really discussed in depth at all or even touched how they had been affected in the long term by what they had witnessed. So I went to these households and to ask these men, how did it change your life to witness the camps? And Mary Charlotte, it was amazing how in almost every case, as soon as the veteran got to the point in their narrative where they entered the gates of the camp, that is when they either dissolved into tears, became extremely choked up and had to leave the room, or just completely changed the subject. They just could not allow themselves to remember that moment where they were really, truly overwhelmed by what they encountered. And we need to know, and this is something I don't think most people understand, that the World War II GIs literally stumbled upon these camps. They'd be marching through the woods, you know, they would be bivouacking up, you know, through a new area, and had no idea. And then there'd be this unbelievable smell was the first thing that they realized was terribly wrong. Then they'd find leaves of trees being totally gray, and they'd swipe them, and it was ash in their hands. And, you know, and it's one thing that I have a difficult time forgiving the top-tier echelon of the military for, because they knew about these camps. Why didn't they warn the troops? Why didn't they give them some psychological preparation for what they would encounter?
Yeah, because the other thing is these people were, by and large, very young men who
18,
had no
19,
idea.
19, yeah.
Yeah. Well, getting back to this question of, okay, so you had the same experience with all these guys. They got to the point where they entered the gates of the concentration camp, and they either dissolved in tears, they choked up, or they left the room, or they changed the subject.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that is a defense mechanism by the human mind, by the human brain, that knows what it's doing because it wants to protect the person from breakdown.
Right.
How is it possible to get past that? How is it possible to get past that? Is that something that you think is possible?
Mm-hmm. Well, I have, ironically, he turned out to be a family friend of my parents, a man named Mike Gold, who lives in Providence, Rhode Island now. He was a POW during the war. He, did the some aerial raids over Germany and crashed and became a POW and suffered terrible trauma and through his adult life struggled with PTSD. And what's amazing for me about that is that I remember how my parents would talk about him. Nobody ever mentioned his role in World War II, and they just kind of, you know, weren't very nice to him, weren't very forgiving for his behavior. And he and I have had some long conversations in the last couple of years, and he started getting help through the VA. He's part of a PTSD support group, and he said, you know, he'll never heal completely, but he's learned how to manage, how to look back, how to be able to look back at his memories without running from them, through writing about them, through talking them through them gradually, you know, with trained therapists, from being with other veterans, dealing with the same difficulties, and realizing how normal it is. I mean, that's the problem, is that if a veteran doesn't get help, they don't realize how what they're going through is really universal to the human spirit.
Right.
They think it's something very wrong about themselves, and that makes it even more difficult. So having a peer group, having a support group, there's someone in Troy, New York, named Dr. Ed Tick, who's written a wonderful book called War and the Soul, and he really sees PTSD as a wound to the soul, because we grow up in a society very committed to the Ten Commandments, and yet we then take our young men and turn them into killers and send them off to violate every moral code they've grown up with. And he said, you can't just expect these people to come back, send them back home, and have everything be fine. And he's modeled his work on that of Native Americans and ancient Greeks and Romans. And after a war, Native Americans bring their warriors back and have them spend weeks, if not months, secluded with other warriors, other veteran warriors. And they do almost a decompression where they talk out. They tell their stories. They share their perspectives. They bring the warrior back into the fold and give them time to process and integrate their experiences. And we don't do that at all. We don't have any kind of a community or process like that, which I think is really essential, rather than sending veterans back home into their households and just total chaos erupting.
We're talking to Lila Levinson, author of the book Gated Grief, the daughter of a GI concentration camp liberator discovers a legacy of trauma. One of the things that I found fascinating was that your experience visiting these people after your father's death, who themselves were camp liberators, you often felt like you were at home, like you really understood them and they knew you, and you were almost part of the family, as if that shared legacy had its own real energy and bond, even for the children.
And I think that's so true, and I think that's one reason why when they received my letters, which is how I first approached them, many, about half of the people who received my letter responded, yes, you know, please, I'd love to come, I'd love you to come visit with me. I think it's because I said I was the daughter of a liberator and that I wanted to understand him. And I almost think it was an unconscious thing on their part. None of these people had shared with their children their experiences, just like my father didn't with me. But I think there is an urge, especially as people get older and see how finite their lives are, for their children to understand them, for their children to know what was really going on. And so, in a way, I became the carrier of the story. I was the one who then gave the story to the children. And I can't tell you how moved I've been by letters I've gotten back by some children of the veterans saying, thank you so much. You know, you have enabled me to understand and forgive my father for things that I just couldn't comprehend as I've been growing up. And I really see that I created a website, Veterans Children, for this purpose, as a bridge between the veterans and their children, because it is sometimes much too difficult to tell the stories yourself directly to the children. So I think if we have sort of a neutral way to do that, until we get better as a society in helping our veterans heal where they can directly tell the stories. That's beginning to happen, by the way, more and more around this country right now. There are many grassroots writing workshops for veterans. Our young men come and women coming home now. And these workshops are enabling these veterans to, instead of locking the stuff up and having them ripple through their family, start processing it through very safe places to start writing it and getting it out of themselves. You know, by writing, you are taking it out of yourself and detoxifying your body by just putting it on paper. So I think we will see a shift in how this divide between parent and child, you know, occurs the more that we make resources available to our veterans. But, yeah, it was wonderful being in their homes. I almost felt like, in many ways, they were standing in for my father, and I have stayed very close with several of them ever since.
Tell us more about veteranschildren.com. Who's the website for? How do people participate in it?
The website is for anyone who has a veteran in their family, and it may not even have been, like, your parent. It might have been your grandparent, because these things can ripple over generations. And it's to read stories of other people, which can then start making you connect the dots in ways you might never have thought about, like, oh, my gosh, my father's alcoholism or my father's suicide. Maybe that had something to do with his World War II service I never thought about. I can't tell you how many people I've had come to me and say that after seeing the website. It's a place for people to find community around pain in their families that has always made them feel very isolated. You know, when you see that other people have suffered in similar ways, it's very, very healing to feel that it's not just you, that this isn't just your family, that this is like some kind of common pattern that connects to this phenomenon of war that we do to ourselves. And then it starts making sense, and then you sort of have a way out of it. You know, you have a way to contextualize it and to start healing from it. And even just this morning when I turned on my email, there was another email from a woman from my website saying, I can't believe this. This is my story. I thought this was just me. People have been telling me for years that I must be imagining this, that she thought so much of her family's issues were connected to her father's war service.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, and if you think about it, you can kind of generalize that out to all different kinds of trauma. So somebody mm-hmm. reading the stories on veteranschildren.com, yeah, maybe they're the child of veterans, or maybe they're the child of a woman who was raped, or maybe they are somebody who experienced some kind of trauma themselves or whatever. It's all ultimately in a sad way, all trauma is very similar in its effects, which is probably just a function of neural architecture.
Right, I completely agree with you. I did an interview the other day, and the man interviewing, I could see kind of lights going off in his head because his father lost a child even before the man interviewing me was born, and the son died very tragically, and he was realizing as we were talking that things about his father he never understood really had been manifestations of trauma from that. Unfortunately, the human being is very vulnerable to trauma. It doesn't take much to traumatize us. Just witnessing a terrible car accident can be traumatic, you know, or coming upon your husband who's fallen off a ladder while fixing the roof and he's lying on the ground. That can be traumatic. You know, so we should never minimize what the effect is on us of a sudden terrifying moment. Because it can ripple through ourselves and our families in ways. You know, any time that we're repressing grief, and our culture is very uncomfortable with grieving, very uncomfortable. And so we need to understand that if we're repressing grief, it's having huge consequences for many other aspects of our lives. That once you censor one emotion, it's going to affect how you're responding and feeling your other emotions, you know, because to repress an emotion is to numb that part of yourself, so that makes you less able to feel the joy in your life.
When I look at Israel, and so many people look at the nation of Israel as this great, beautiful hope after World War II and a place of safety and a place of security that over the years evolved into something that looks like a nation of people with PTSD and the treatment of the Palestinians, which is so horrifying that it's beyond imagination once you find out actually what's going on there. How do you think about that? I mean, when one thinks about the lessons learned from World War II and then you look at the trauma that's being created all over again, not mm-hmm. on the same scale, but how do you think about that?
Well, I first have to say the caveat that I've never been to Israel. And I don't know many Israelis directly, so, you know, that disqualifies me from saying anything with much authority. But I do know that for Holocaust survivors in Israel, for many decades after the war ended, Israel didn't want to hear about their experiences. It was very important in Israel not to be a victim, but to be a warrior. And if we think about everything else I've said up till now about the consequences of repressing trauma and of not dealing with your grief, then think about what that would do to a country as a whole, to have had so many of its citizens suffer terrible, terrible trauma and not have an opportunity to process it, to bring it into the community, to be able to talk about it. So Yeah, one of the points that gated grief makes is that we are really dooming ourselves to repeat trauma over every generation unless we become conscious of it, unless we integrate it and bring it out into the light. And we have to put a value on grieving and of really, really honoring the costs for an entire society of going to war, of using war as a solution.
Lila Levinson is the author of the book Gated Grief, The Daughter of a GI Concentration Camp Liberator Discovers a Legacy of Trauma. The memoir has just been published, and I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much, Mary Charlotte. I've really enjoyed this time with you. Great questions.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.